For the next 6 years, the old man slid relentlessly into the darkness of Alzheimer's. If he was faking, he gave a brilliant performance. Down he went through the descending way stations of incontinence, incoherence, frequent outbursts of anger, loss of memory, loss of the ability to feed himself, loss of personality. He dwindled into infancy, then into vacuity, and spent his days strapped into a wheelchair. Chipper mourned the inevitable loss of a uniquely cooperative patient. Then, in the summer of the year before these events, the amazing resuscitation occurred. Animation returned to Bernie's slack face, and he began to utter vehement nonsense syllables. Abala, Gorg, Munshun, Gorg. He wanted to feed himself. He wanted to exercise his legs, to stagger around and reacquaint himself with his surroundings. Within a week, he was using English words to insist on wearing his own clothes and going to the bathroom by himself. He put on weight, gained strength, once again became a nuisance. Now, often in the same day, he passes back and forth between late-stage Alzheimer's lifelessness and a guarded, gleaming surliness so healthy in a man of 85, it might be called robust. Bernie is like a man who went to Lourdes and experienced a cure, but left before it was complete. For Chipper, a miracle is a miracle. As long as the old creep stays alive, who cares if he is wandering the grounds or drooping against the restraining strap in his wheelchair? We move closer. We try to ignore the stench. We want to see what we can glean from the face of this curious fellow. It was never a pretty face, and now the skin is gray and the cheeks are sunken potholes. Prominent blue veins wind over the gray scalp, spotted as a plover's egg. The rubbery-looking nose hooks slightly to the right, which adds to the impression of slyness and concealment. The wormy lips curl in a disquieting smile, the smile of an arsonist contemplating a burning building that may, after all, be merely a grimace. Here is a true American loner, an internal vagrant, a creature of shabby rooms and cheap diners, of aimless journeys resentfully taken, a collector of wounds and injuries lovingly fingered and refingered. Here is a spy with no cause higher than himself. Bernie's real name is Carl Bierstone, and under this name he conducted in Chicago from his mid-20s until the age of 46, a secret rampage, an unofficial war, during which he committed wretched deeds for the sake of the pleasures they afforded him. Carl Bierstone is Bernie's great secret, for he cannot allow anyone to know that this former incarnation, this earlier self, still lives inside his skin. Carl Bierstone's awful pleasures, his foul toys, are also Bernie's, and he must keep them hidden in the darkness where only he can find them. So, is that the answer to Chipper's miracle? That Carl Bierstone found a way to creep out through a seam in Bernie's zombiedom and assume control of the foundering ship? The human soul contains an infinity of rooms, after all, some of them vast, some no bigger than a broom closet, some locked, some few imbued with a radiant light. We bow closer to the veiny scalp, the wandering nose, the wire-brush eyebrows. We lean deeper into the stink to examine those interesting eyes. They are like black neon. They glitter like moonlight on a sodden riverbank. All in all, they look unsettlingly gleeful, but not particularly human. Not much help here. Bernie's lips move. He is still smiling, if you can call that rictus a smile. But he has begun to whisper. What is he saying?
They are gouring in their bloody holes and gouring their eyes. They're whimpering in terror, my poor lost babies. No, no, that won't help, will it? Ah, see the engines, yes. Oh, those beautiful, beautiful engines. What a sight. The beautiful engines against the wire. How they churn and burn. I see a hole, yes, yes, there it is. Oh, oh, so bright around the edges, so folded back.
Carl Bierstone may be reporting in, but his babble is not of much help. Let us follow the direction of Bernie's mud-glitter gaze in hopes that it might give us a hint as to what has so excited the old boy. Aroused, too, as we observe from the shape beneath the sheet. He and Chipper seem to be in sync here, since both are standing at the ready, except that instead of the benefit of Rebecca Vilas's expert attentions, Bernie's only stimulation is the view through his window. The view hardly measures up to Miss Vilas. Head slightly elevated upon a pillow, Charles Burnside looks raptly out over a brief expanse of lawn to a row of maple trees at the beginning of an extensive woods. Farther back tower the great leafy heads of oaks. A few birch trunks shine candle-like in the inner darkness. From the height of the oaks and the variety of the trees, we know that we are regarding a remnant of the great climax forest that once blanketed this entire part of the country. Like all of the ancient forest's traces, the woods extending north and east from Maxton's speak of profound mysteries, in a voice nearly too deep to be heard. Beneath its green canopy, time and serenity embrace bloodshed and death. Violence roils on, unseen, constantly, absorbed into every aspect of a hushed landscape that never pauses but moves with glacial lack of haste. The spangled, yielding floor covers millions of scattered bones in layer upon layer. All that grows and thrives here thrives on rot. Worlds within worlds churn, and great systematic universes hum side by side, each ignorantly bringing abundance and catastrophe upon its unguessed-at neighbors. Does Bernie contemplate these woods? Is he enlivened by what he sees in them? Or, for that matter, is he in fact still asleep? And does Carl Bierstone caper behind Charles Burnside's peculiar eyes? Bernie whispers, "Foxes. Down fog's holes, rads in rat holes, hyenas over empty stomachs wail. Oh, ah, this is most, most gladsome, my friends. More and more the little ones drudge, 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 oh, ho, on bleeding footsies." Let's blow this pop stand, okay? Let's sail away from old Bernie's ugly mouth. Enough is enough. Let us seek the fresh air and fly north over the woods. Foxes down foxholes and rats in rat holes may be wailing, true, that's how it works. But we are not about to find any starving hyenas in western Wisconsin. Hyenas are always hungry anyhow. No one feels sorry for them either. You'd have to be a real bleeding heart to pity a creature that does nothing but skulk around the periphery of other species until the moment when, grinning and chuckling, it can plunder their leftovers. Out we go, right through the roof. East of Maxton's, the woods carpet the ground for something like a mile or two before a narrow dirt road curves in from Highway 35 like a careless parting in a thick head of hair. The woods continue for another 100 yards or so, then yield to a 30-year-old housing development consisting of two streets. Basketball hoops, backyard swing sets, tricycles, bicycles, and vehicles by Fisher Price clutter the driveways of the modest houses on Schubert and Gale. The children who will make use of them lie abed, dreaming of cotton candy, puppy dogs, home runs, excursions to distant territories, and other delightful infinitudes. Also asleep, are their anxious parents, doomed to become even more so after reading Wendell Green's contribution to the front page of the day's Herald. Something catches our eye. That narrow dirt road curving into the woods from Highway 35 straightaway. More a lane than an actual road, its air of privacy seems at odds with its apparent uselessness. The lane loops off into the woods, and three-fourths of a mile later comes to an end. What is its point? What is it for? From our height above the earth, the track resembles a faint line sketched by a number four pencil. You practically need an eagle's eye to see it at all. But someone went to considerable effort to draw this line through the woods. Trees had to be cut and cleared, stumps to be pried from the ground. If one man did it, the work would have taken months of sweaty, muscle-straining labor. The result of all that inhuman effort has the remarkable property of concealing itself, of evading the eye so that it fades away if attention wanders, and must be located again. We might think of dwarfs and secret dwarf mines, the path to a dragon's hidden cache of gold, a treasure so safeguarded that access to it has been camouflaged by a magic spell. No, dwarf mines, dragon treasures, and magic spells are too childish. But when we drop down for a closer examination, we see that a weathered no trespassing sign stands at the beginning of the lane, proof that something is being guarded, even if it is merely privacy. Having noticed the sign, we look again at the end of the lane. In the darkness under the trees down there, one area seems murkier than the rest. Even as it shrinks back into the gloom, this area possesses an unnatural stolidity that distinguishes it from the surrounding trees. Aha, oh ho, we say to ourselves in an echo of Bernie's gibberish, what have we here, a wall of some kind? It seems that featureless. When we reach the midpoint in the curve of the lane, a triangular section of darkness all but obscured by the treetops abruptly defines itself as a peaked roof. Not until we are nearly upon it does the entire structure move into definition as a three-story wooden house, oddly shambling in structure with a low, sagging front porch. This house has clearly stood empty for a long time. And after taking in its eccentricity, the first thing we notice is its inhospitability to new tenants. A second no-trespassing sign, leaning sideways at an improbable angle against a newel post, merely underlines the impression given by the building itself. The peaked roof covers only the central section. To the left, a two-story extension retreats back into the woods. On the right, the building sprouts low additions like outsized sheds, more like growths than afterthoughts. In both senses of the word, the building looks unbalanced. An off-kilter mind conceived it, then relentlessly brought it into off-center being. The intractable result deflects inquiry and resists interpretation. An odd, monolithic invulnerability emanates from the bricks and boards, despite the damage done by time and weather. Obviously built in search of seclusion, if not isolation, the house seems still to demand them. Oddest of all, from our vantage point, the house appears to have been painted a uniform black. Not only the boards, but every inch of the exterior, the porch, the trim, the rain gutters, even the windows. Black, from top to bottom. And that cannot be possible. In this guileless, good-hearted corner of the world, not even the most crazily misanthropic builder would turn his house into its own shadow. We float down to just above ground level, and move nearer along the narrow lane. When we come close enough for reliable judgment, which is uncomfortably close, we find that misanthropy can go further than we had supposed. The house is not black now, but it used to be. What it has faded into makes us feel that we might have been too critical about the original color. The house has become the leaden gray-black of thunderheads and dismal seas and the hulls of wrecked ships. Black would be preferable to this utter lifelessness. We may be certain that very few of the adults who live in the nearby development, or any adults in French Landing or the surrounding towns, have defied the admonition on 35 and ventured up the narrow lane. Almost none so much as notice the sign anymore. None of them know of the existence of the Black House. We can be just as certain, however, that a number of their children have explored the lane, and that some of those children wandered far enough to come upon the house. They would have seen it in a way their parents could not, and what they saw would have sent them racing back toward the highway. The Black House seems as out of place in western Wisconsin as a skyscraper or a moated palace. In fact, the Black House would be an anomaly anywhere in our world, except perhaps as a haunted mansion, a castle of terrors in an amusement park, where its capacity to repel ticket buyers would put it out of business within a week. Yet, in one specific way, it might remind us of the dim buildings along the ascent of Chase Street into respectability from the riverbank and Nail House Row. The shabby Nelson Hotel, the obscure tavern, the shoe store, and the others, marked with the horizontal stripe drawn by the river's grease pencil, share the same eerie, dreamlike, half-unreal flavor that saturates the Black House. At this moment in our progress, and through everything that follows, we would do well to remember that this strange flavor of the dreamlike and slightly unnatural is characteristic of borderlands. It can be detected in every seam between one specific territory and another, however significant or insignificant the border in question. Borderlands places are different from other places. They are borderish. Say you happen to be driving for the first time through a semi-rural section of Oostler County in your home state, on your way to visit a recently divorced friend of the opposite sex, who has abruptly and, you think, unwisely decamped to a small town in adjacent Orlost County. On the passenger seat beside you, atop a picnic basket containing two bottles of a superior white Bordeaux held tightly in place by various gourmet goodies in exquisite little containers, lies a map carefully folded to expose the relevant area. You may not know your exact location, but you are on the right road and making good time. Gradually, the landscape alters. The road veers around a non-existent berm, then begins winding through inexplicable curves. On either side, the trees slouch. Beneath their twisted boughs, the intermittent houses grow smaller and seedier. Ahead, a three-legged dog squirms through a hedge and barrels, snarling toward your right front tire. A crone wearing a teensy straw hat and what appears to be a shroud glances up red-eyed from a listing porch swing. Two front yards along, a little girl costumed in dirty pink gauze and a foil crown flaps a glittery star-headed wand over a heap of burning tires. Then a rectangular placard bearing the legend, "Welcome to Orlost County," glides into view. Soon the trees improve their posture, and the road straightens out. Released from anxieties barely noticed until they were gone, you nudge the accelerator and hasten toward your needy friend. Borderlands taste of unruliness and distortion. The grotesque, the unpredictable, and the lawless take root in them and luxuriate. The central Borderlands flavor is of slippage. And while we are in a setting of wondrous natural beauty, we have also been traveling over a natural borderland, delineated by a great river and defined by other lesser rivers, wide glacial moraines, limestone cliffs, and valleys that remain invisible, like the Black House, until you turn the right corner and meet them face to face. Have you ever seen a furious old wreck in worn-out clothes who pushes an empty shopping cart down deserted streets and rants about a fucking thief? Sometimes he wears a baseball cap, sometimes a pair of sunglasses with one cracked lens. Have you ever moved, frightened, into a doorway and watched a soldierly man with a zigzag lightning bolt scar on one side of his face storm into a drunken mob and discover lying spread-eagled in death on the ground, a boy, his head smashed and his pockets turned out? Have you seen the anger and the pity blaze in that man's mutilated face? These are signs of slippage. Another lies concealed below us, on the outskirts of French Landing. And despite the terror and heartbreak that surround this sign, we have no choice but to stand in witness before it. By our witness we shall do it honor, to the measure of our individual capabilities. By being witnessed, by offering its testimony to our mute gaze, it will repay us in measure far greater. We are back in midair, and spread out, we could say spread-eagled out, beneath us, French County sprawls like a topographical map. The morning sunlight, stronger now, glows on green rectangular fields and dazzles off the lightning rods rising from the tops of barns. The roads look clean. Molten pools of light shine from the tops of the few cars drifting toward town along the edges of the fields. Holsteins nudge pasture gates, ready for the confinement of their stanchions and the morning's date with the milking machine. At a safe distance from the black house, which has already given us an excellent example of slippage, we are gliding eastward, crossing the long, straight ribbon of 11th Street and beginning a journey into a transitional area of scattered houses and small businesses before Highway 35 cuts through actual farmland. The 7-Eleven slips by, and the VFW hall, where the flagpole will not display Old Glory for another 45 minutes. In one of the houses set back from the road, a woman named Wanda Kinderling, the wife of Thornburg Kinderling, a wicked and foolish man serving a life sentence in the state prison at Waupun, awakens, eyes the level of the vodka in the bottle on her bedside table, and decides to postpone breakfast for another hour. 50 yards along, gleaming tractors in military rows face the giant steel and glass bubble of Ted Goltz's farm implement dealership, French County Farm Equipment, where a decent, troubled husband and father named Fred Marshall, whom we shall be meeting before long, will soon report for work. Beyond the showy glass bubble and the asphalt sea of Goltz's parking lot, a half mile of stony, long-neglected field eventually degenerates into bare earth and spindly weeds. At the end of a long, overgrown turn-in, what seems to be a pile of rotting lumber stands between an old shed and an antique gas pump. This is our destination. We glide toward the earth. The heap of lumber resolves into a leaning, dilapidated structure on the verge of collapse. An old tin Coca-Cola sign, pocked with bullet holes, tilts against the front of the building. Beer cans and the milkweed of old cigarette filters litter the scrubby ground. From within comes the steady, somnolent buzz of a great many flies. We wish to retreat into the cleansing air and depart. The black house was pretty bad. In fact, it was terrible. But this is going to be worse. One secondary definition of slippage is the feeling that things in general have just gotten, or very shortly will get, worse. The ruined boxcar-shaped shack before us used to house a comically ill-run and unsanitary establishment called Ed's Eats and Dogs. From behind an eternally messy counter, a chortling 350-pound mass of blubber named Ed Gilbertson once served up greasy, overdone hamburgers, bologna and mayonnaise sandwiches ornamented with black thumbprints and oozing ice cream cones to a small, undiscriminating clientele, mostly local children who arrived on bicycles. Now long deceased, Ed was one of the numerous uncles of French Landing's chief of police, Dale Gilbertson, and a good-hearted slob and dimwit of great local renown. His cook's apron was of an indescribable filthiness. The state of his hands and fingernails would have brought any visiting health inspector to the verge of nausea. His utensils might as well have been cleaned by cats. Immediately behind the counter, tubs of melting ice cream cooked in the heat from the crusted griddle. Overhead, limp flypaper ribbons hung invisible within the fur of 1,000 fly corpses. The unlovely truth is that for decades, Ed's Eats permitted generation upon generation of microbes and germs to multiply unchecked, swarming from floor, counter, and griddle, not hesitating to colonize Ed himself, to spatula, fork, and the unwashed ice cream scoop, thence into the horrible food, finally into the mouths and guts of the kids who ate that stuff, plus those of the occasional mother. Remarkably, no one ever died from eating at Ed's, and after a long overdue heart attack felled its proprietor one day, when he mounted a stool for the purpose of finally tacking up 12 new strips of flypaper, nobody had the heart to raise his little shack and clear away the rubble. For 25 years, under the shelter of darkness, its rotting shell has welcomed romantic teenage couples, as well as gatherings of boys and girls in need of a secluded place to investigate for the first time in recorded history, or so it seemed to them, the liberation of drunkenness. The rapt buzzing of the flies tells us that whatever we might be about to witness within this ruin will be neither a pair of spent young lovers nor a few silly, passed-out kids. That soft, greedy uproar, inaudible from the road, declares the presence of ultimate things. We could say that it represents a kind of portal. We enter. Mild sunlight filtering in through gaps in the eastern wall and the battered roof paints luminous streaks across the gritty floor. Feathers, dust, eddy and stir over animal tracks and the dim impressions left by many long-gone shoes. Threadbare army surplus blankets speckled with mold lie crumpled against the wall to our left. A few feet away, discarded beer cans and flattened cigarette ends surround a kerosene-burning hurricane lamp with a cracked glass housing. The sunlight lays warm stripes over crisp footprints, advancing in a wide curve around the remains of Ed's appalling counter and into the vacancy formerly occupied by the stove, a sink, and a rank of storage shelves. There, in what once was Ed's sacred domain, the footprints vanish. Some ferocious activity has scattered the dust and grit, and something that is not an old army blanket, though we wish it were, lies disarrayed against the rear wall, half in, half out of a dark, irregular pool of tacky liquid. Delirious flies hover and settle upon the dark pool. In the far corner, a rust-colored mongrel with quill-like hair gets its teeth into the knuckle of meat and bone, protruding from the white object held between its front paws. The white object is a running shoe, a sneaker, a New Balance sneaker, to be exact. To be more exact, a child's New Balance sneaker, size 5. We want to invoke our capacity for flight and get the hell out of here. We want to float through the unresisting roof, to regain the harmless air, but we cannot. We must bear witness. An ugly dog is chewing on a child's severed foot, while making every effort to extract the foot from the white New Balance sneaker. The mongrel's scrawny back arches down and extends, the quilled shoulders and narrow head drop, the bony front legs rigidly clamp the prize, tug, 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 but the sneaker's laces are tied, too bad for the mutt. As for the something that is not an old army surplus blanket, beyond a swirl of dusty tracks and furrows at the floor's far edge, Its pale form lies flattened and face up on the floor, its top half extending out of the dark pool. One arm stretches limply out into the grit, the other props upright against the wall. The fingers of both hands curl palmward. Blunt, strawberry-blonde hair flops back from the small face. If the eyes and mouth display any recognizable expression, it is that of mild surprise. This is an accident of structure. It means nothing. For the configuration of this child's face caused her to look faintly surprised even while she was asleep. Bruises, like ink stains and eraser smudges, lie upon her cheekbones, her temple, her neck. A white T-shirt bearing the logo of the Milwaukee Brewers and smeared with dirt and dried blood covers her torso from neck to navel. The lower half of her body, pale as smoke except where drizzled with blood, lengthens into the dark pool where the ecstatic flies hover and settle. Her bare, slender left leg incorporates a scabby knee and concludes with the uptick of a blood-stained New Balance sneaker, size 5, laces double-knotted, toe pointed to the ceiling. Where the partner to this leg should be is a vacancy, for her right hip ends abruptly at a ragged stump. We are in the presence of the fisherman's third victim, 10-year-old Irma Freneau. The shockwaves aroused by her disappearance yesterday afternoon from the sidewalk outside the video store will increase in force and number after Dale Gilbertson comes upon her body a little over a day from now. The fisherman gathered her up on Chase Street and transported her, we cannot say how, up the length of Chase Street and Lyle Road, past the 7-Eleven and the VFW Hall, past the house where Wanda Kinderling seethes and drinks, past the shiny glass spaceship of Goltz's, and across the border between town and farmland. She was alive when the fisherman moved her through the doorway next to the pockmarked Coca-Cola sign. She must have struggled, she must have screamed. The fisherman brought her to the rear wall and silenced her with blows to the face. Very likely he strangled her. He lowered her body to the floor and arranged her limbs. Except for the white New Balance sneakers, he removed all the clothing from her waist down, underwear, jeans, shorts, whatever Irma had been wearing when he abducted her. After that, the fisherman amputated her right leg. Using some sort of long, heavy-bladed knife, and without the assistance of cleaver or saw, he parted flesh and bone until he had managed to detach the leg from the rest of the body. Then, perhaps with no more than 2 or 3 downward chops to the ankle, he severed the foot. He tossed it, still contained within the white sneaker, aside. Irma's foot was not important to the fisherman. All he wanted was her leg. Here, my friends, we have true slippage. Irma Freneau's small, inert body seems to flatten out, as if it intends to melt through the rotting floorboards. The drunken flies sing on. The dog keeps trying to yank the whole of its juicy prize out of the sneaker. Were we to bring simple-minded Ed Gilbertson back to life and stand him beside us, he would sink to his knees and weep. We, on the other hand, we are not here to weep. Not like Ed, anyhow, in horrified shame and disbelief. A tremendous mystery has inhabited this hovel, and its effects and traces hover everywhere about us. We have come to observe, register, and record the impressions, the after-images left in the comet trail of the mystery. It speaks from their details, therefore it lingers in its own wake, therefore it surrounds us. A deep, deep gravity flows outward from the scene, and this gravity humbles us. Humility is our best, most accurate first response. Without it, we would miss the point. The great mystery would escape us, and we would go on deaf and blind, ignorant as pigs. Let us not go on like pigs. We must honor this scene, the flies, the dog worrying the severed foot, the poor, pale body of Irma Freneau, the magnitude of what befell Irma Freneau, by acknowledging our littleness. In comparison, we are no more than vapors. A fat bee wanders in through the empty window frame in the sidewall, 6 feet from Irma's body, and makes a slow exploratory circuit around the rear of the shack. Suspended beneath its blurred wings, the bee looks nearly too heavy for flight, but it proceeds with easy, unhurried deliberation, moving well above the bloody floor in a wide curve. The flies, the mongrel, and Irma pay it no attention. For us, though, the bee, which continues to drift contentedly about the rear of the horror chamber, has ceased to be a welcome distraction and has been absorbed into the surrounding mystery. It is a detail within the scene, and it, too, commands our humility and speaks. The weighty, burrowing rumble of its wings seems to define the exact center of the undulating sound waves higher in pitch produced by the greedy flies. Like a singer at a microphone in front of a chorus, the bee controls the aural background. The sound gathers and comes to a serious point when the bee ambles into a shaft of yellow light streaming through the eastern wall. Its stripes glow black and gold, the wings coalesce into a fan, and the insect becomes an intricate airborne wonder. The slaughtered girl flattens into the bloody floorboards. Our humility, our sense of littleness, our appreciation of the gravity deeply embedded in this scene grant us the sense of forces and powers beyond our understanding, of a kind of grandeur always present and at work, but perceptible only during moments like this. We have been honored, but the honor is unbearable. The speaking bee circles back to the window and passes into another world, and following his lead, we move on, out the window, into the sun, and into the upper air. Smells of shit and urine at Maxton Elder Care. The fragile, slick feel of slippage at the off-kilter house north of Highway 35. The sound of the flies and the sight of the blood at the former Ed's Eats. Ach, yuck. Is there no place here in French Landing, we may ask, where there is something nice under the skin? Where what we see is what we get, so to speak? The short answer, no. French Landing should be marked with big road signs at every point of ingress, warning, slippage in progress, pass at your own risk. The magic at work here is Fisher magic. It has rendered nice, at least temporarily, obsolete. But we can go someplace nicer, and if we can, we probably should, because we need a break. We may not be able to escape slippage, but we can at least visit where no one shits the bed or bleeds on the floor. At least not yet. So the bee goes its way and we go ours. Ours takes us southwest, over more woods, exhaling their fragrance of life and oxygen. There is no air like this air, at least not in this world. And then back to the works of man again. This section of town is called Libertyville, so named by the French Landing Town Council in 1976. You won't believe this, but big-bellied Ed Gilbertson, the hot dog king himself, was a member of that bicentennial band of town fathers. Those were strange days, pretty mama, strange days indeed. Not as strange as these, however, in French Landing. These are the Fisher days, the slippery slippage days. The streets of Libertyville have names that adults find colorful and children find painful. Some of the latter have been known to call this area of town Faggotyville. Let us descend now down through the sweet morning air. It's warming up already. This will be a strawberry fest kind of day for sure. We cruise silently over Camelot Street, past the intersection of Camelot and Avalon, and travel on down Avalon to Maid Marian Way. From Maid Marian, we progress to, is it any surprise, Robin Hood Lane. Here, at number 16, a sweet little Cape Cod honey of a home that looks just right for the decent, hard-working family on its way up, we find a kitchen window open. There is the smell of coffee and toast, a wonderful combined odor that denies slippage, if only we did not know better, if only we had not seen the dog at work eating a foot out of a sneaker as a child might eat the hot dog right out of its bun. And we follow the aroma in. It's nice to be invisible, isn't it? To watch in our godlike silence. If only what our godlike eyes saw was just a little less goddamn upsetting. But that is by the way. We're in it now, for better or for worse, and we had better get on about our business. Daylight's a-wasting, as they say, in this part of the world. Here in the kitchen of number 16 is Fred Marshall, whose picture currently graces the Salesman of the Month easel in the showroom of French County Farm Equipment. Fred has also been named Employee of the Year 3 years out of the last four. 2 years ago, Ted Goltz gave the award to Otto Eisman just to break the monotony. And when he is on the job, no one radiates more charm, personality, or all-around niceness. You wanted nice? Ladies and gentlemen, presenting Fred Marshall. Only now his confident smile is not in evidence, and his hair, always carefully combed on the job, hasn't yet seen the brush. He's wearing Nike shorts and a tee with cut-off sleeves instead of his usual pressed khakis and sport shirt. On the counter is the Marshall copy of the La Riviere Herald, open to an inside page. Fred has his share of problems just lately, or rather his wife Judy has problems, and what's hers is his, so said the minister when he joined them in holy wedlock. And what he's reading isn't making him feel any better. Far from it. It's a sidebar to the lead story on the front page, and of course the author is everyone's favorite muckraker, Wendell Fisherman Still at Large Green. The sidebar is your basic recap of the first two murders, gruesome and gruesomer is how Fred thinks of them. And as he reads, Fred bends first his left leg up behind him and then his right, stretching those all-important thigh muscles and preparing for his morning run. What could be more anti-slippage than a morning run? What could be nicer? What could possibly spoil such a lovely start to such a beautiful Wisconsin day? Well, how about this? Johnny Erkenham's dreams were simple enough according to his grief-stricken father. Grief-stricken father, Fred thinks, stretching and imagining his son asleep upstairs. Dear God, save me from ever being a grief-stricken father. Not knowing, of course, how soon he must assume this role. Johnny wanted to be an astronaut, George Erkenham said, a smile briefly lighting his exhausted face. When he wasn't putting out fires for the French Landing FD or fighting crime with the Justice League of America, that is. These innocent dreams ended in a nightmare we cannot imagine. But I'm sure you'll try, Fred thinks, now beginning his toe raises. Last Monday, his dismembered body was discovered by Spencer Hovdahl of Centralia. Hovdahl, a First Farmer State Bank loan officer, was inspecting an abandoned French Landing farm owned by John Ellison, who lives in a neighboring county, with an eye to initiating repossession proceedings. I didn't want to be there in the first place, Hovdahl told this reporter. If there's anything I hate, it's the repo stuff. Knowing Spence Hovdahl as he does, Fred very much doubts if stuff was the word he used. I wanted to be there even less after I went into the hen house. It's all rickety and falling down, and I would have stayed out except for the sound of the bees. I thought there might be a hive in there. Bees are an interest of mine, and I was curious. God help me, I was curious. I hope I'll never be curious again. What he found in the hen house was the body of 7-year-old John Wesley Erkenham. The corpse had been dismembered, the pieces hung from the henhouse's decaying rafters by chains. Although Police Chief Dale Gilbertson would neither confirm nor deny it, Reliable police sources in La Riviere say that the thighs, torso, and buttocks had been bitten. Okay, that's enough for Fred. Everybody out of the pool. He sweeps the newspaper closed and shoves it all the way down the counter to the Mr. Coffee. By God, they never put stuff like that in the paper when he was a kid. And why the fishermen, for heaven's sake? Why do they have to tag every monster with a catchy nickname, turn a guy like whoever did this into the celebrity sicko of the month? Of course, nothing like this had ever happened when he was Tyler's age, but the principle, the goddamn principle of the matter. Fred finishes his toe raises, reminding himself to have a talk with Tyler. It'll be harder than their little talk about why his thing sometimes gets hard, but it absolutely must be done. Buddy system, Fred will say. You've got to stick with your buddies now, Ty. No more rambling around on your own for a while, okay? Yet the idea of Ty actually being murdered seems remote to Fred. It is the stuff of TV docudramas, or maybe a Wes Craven movie. Call it Scream 4 The Fisherman. In fact, wasn't there a movie sort of like that? A guy in a fisherman's slicker wandering around and killing teenagers with a hook? Maybe. But not little kids. Not babies like Amy St. Pierre and Johnny Erkenham. Jesus, the world was disintegrating right in front of him. Body parts hanging from chains in a crumbling henhouse. That is the part which haunts him. Can that really be? Can it be here, right here and now, in Tom Sawyer, Becky Thatcher country? Well, let it go. It's time to run. But maybe the paper kind of got lost this morning, Fred thinks, picking it up from the counter and folding it until it looks like a thick paperback book. But part of the headline accuses him, even so. Fisherman still at l... Maybe the paper just kind of, I don't know, migrated straight to the old garbage can beside the house. Yes, good idea. Because Judy has been strange lately. And Wendell Green's pulsating stories about the fishermen are not helping. Thighs and torso bitten, Fred thinks, as he glides through the early morning quiet house toward the door. And while you're at it, waiter, have him cut me a nice rare chunk of butt. She reads the press accounts obsessively, making no comment, but Fred doesn't like the way her eyes jump around, or some of the other tics she's picked up. The obsessive touching of her tongue to her upper lip, for instance. And sometimes, this in the last 2 or 3 days, he has seen her tongue reach all the way up and petted her philtrum just below her nose, a feat he would have thought impossible if he had not seen it again last night during the local news. She goes to bed earlier and earlier, and sometimes she talks in her sleep, strange, slurry words that don't sound like English. Sometimes when Fred speaks to her, she doesn't respond, simply stares off into space, eyes wide, lips moving slightly, hands kneading together. Cuts and scratches have begun to show up on the backs of them, even though she keeps her nails cropped sensibly short. Ty has noticed his mother's encroaching oddities, too. On Saturday, while father and son were having lunch together, Judy was upstairs taking one of her long naps, another new wrinkle. The boy suddenly asked, right out of a blue, clear sky, "What's wrong with Mom?" "Ty, nothing's wrong with—" "There is. Tommy Erpter says she's a Coke short of a Happy Meal these days." And had he almost reached across the tomato soup and toasted cheese sandwiches and clouded his son, his only child? Good old Ty, who was nothing but concerned? God help him, he had.